It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Rob Ferrett.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up, we learn about Earth Dinner, an effort to create a new Earth Day tradition.
First, students around the state are taking the state-mandated standardized tests, including the Common Core-based Badger exam. But controversy over these tests has led some parents to opt out for their kids here in Wisconsin. That reflects a national trend of families avoiding similar tests around the country.
Molly Beck is with us now to talk about the surge of students opting out of standardized tests. She's the education reporter at the Wisconsin State Journal. Molly, welcome back to Central Time.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Well, this has been a big story in the past year, the move for parents to opt their kids out of some of the standardized testing being done in school. How would you describe the momentum of that movement right now?
I think there's more and more parents who are opposed to the increased number of tests that kids are taking in schools, whether it's state-mandated or tests that school districts are giving their students to measure, you know, how they're doing throughout the year. And there's also, you know, opposition to how test scores are used in school accountability measures, and also, you know, to evaluate teachers. I think all of that is kind of combining right now to more and more parents being vocal about this.
You've spoken with a lot of these parents, a sampling of them, to see what they have to say about the opt-out movement and also why they might choose to have their kids take the test that the school is giving. What have they told you about how they're feeling about the number of tests right now and their usefulness?
Sure. The parents that I spoke to who are opting out, they're doing it for a couple reasons. One, like I said before, that they just think their kids are being tested too much. But another reason is to kind of make a statement. They're taking this year as an opportunity to make the statement that they think that the tests are not being used in the right ways and, in their view, are being used for purposes that could punish schools, so to speak. And this year is a year that they can do that because the scores are likely not going to be used to evaluate teachers or on a school report card based on some legislation that's been proposed in Wisconsin that seems to have pretty broad support.
In Wisconsin, what happens when a student opts not to take a test?
I know that in Madison, at least, the kids are either given alternative instruction or they go to the library and do some reading or some sort of assignment. But they're still at the school, and the school district is, you know, tending to them. They're not alone or at home or anything like that.
And is there any negative mark on their academic record?
That student who opts out is counted as a zero in that school's overall score. So that does, you know, bring the average on a school report card down a little bit from the state's perspective.
So how does the fact that some students opt out affect the overall results of these specifically state-mandated tests?
Sure. You know, when you get, there's some schools, I think they're at about 25% students are opting out, and I spoke with the director of research and data at the school district in Madison, and he said when you get to that point, the overall data that you're looking at, the quality is, you know, lessened because you obviously have a chunk of students that aren't taking it. So to truly know how that school is doing, you know, you can't trust the data as much as you could if everybody was taking it.
We're talking right now with the Wisconsin State Journal's Molly Beck. She's joining us to talk about parents opting their kids out of standardized tests in Wisconsin. And a test that is going on in Madison pretty much right now, the Badger exam. This one relates to the Common Core standards. Where is this right now, both in the opt-out movement and the importance to the Common Core?
Well, this test is the first time that Wisconsin students will be measured how well they're doing, you know, learning each subject, the math and the reading, according to the Common Core state standards. And those standards are benchmarks for students, what they should know at each grade level. And this is the first time that schools will be tested on that to see how they're doing with that. So as, you know, the opt-out movement, so to speak, builds, I think it's tied to some of the controversy around Common Core because these tests are aligned to Common Core and that's why they're here. So that's also an element to this.
And the governor has said that he might get rid of this test next year. There's a lot of uncertainty around this particular test. So what incentive do schools have to give the test?
Well, the federal law requires school districts to take an annual test like this. And so if they didn't take the test, if the state didn't ask them to require them to take the test, they could lose federal funding. That has never happened, but that is a possibility.
So with this Badger exam, you looked at Madison to see how it was faring with the opt-out movement, if you will. What did you find?
There's about 590 students opting out of some tests this year, and 519 of those are opting out of the Badger exam. And that's up considerably from the 87 students that opted out of the WKCE last school year. So that's a huge surge. I don't know if that will continue because, like I said, there's some special circumstances this school year, but it's certainly worth noting.
Do you know whether other districts are seeing an opt-out rate that's as high as Madison's?
I checked around, and they're not seeing a spike like that, so to speak, but I know in Sun Prairie, I think there is in the 30s, 30, 34 students opting out, and in Middleton there was 16, but in Monona Grove there was only 2 students who opted out.
Earlier on we talked about how the perception with some parents was that there were just too many tests now, and that was one of the reasons that they were opting their children out of the standardized test, whatever it may be, from the school or from the state. Do you know whether that's true about how many tests there are now compared to, say, 10, 15 years ago?
Sure, yeah. I talked to one parent who said that he had a daughter, his oldest daughter was in about fourth or fifth grade about a decade ago, and he said that he remembers about 2 standardized tests. I don't know if that's true for that year, but he was comparing that to, he has 2 kids who are in about that age now, and he feels like there's a test being given about every month. And I checked with the Department of Public Instruction, and there's around 12 state mandated tests for students across various grade levels, and confirmed with them that 10 years ago there were many fewer, and now they're younger and younger kids are being tested too, and that's also combined with just the test that the school district gives too.
And then are there also school district-only tests?
Right.
Or even individual school tests on top of the state tests?
Yep. There's that, and, the Madison School District, they have their own assessments that they do. There's a test called the MAP assessment, and that's given multiple times during the school year to measure how a student's doing as they're progressing through the school year. And so there's when I spoke to the superintendent, she said there's been a transition in the last few years of school districts having their own assessment strategies and giving their own assessments, and now there's a lot of state-mandated tests that are being given more and more, and there's kind of an overlap right now.
It sounds as though some parents see this as an issue between state control of the school and the testing and school control of the testing. What have they said about how they frame that particular argument?
Sure. Yeah, a couple of parents that I spoke to, they said that, the district doesn't have any control over what happens to these test scores and with the tests that are mandated by the state. And that's one reason that they're choosing to opt their students out of taking them, because they don't agree with what's happening.
Has there been any motion that you've seen to consider opting out a right legally? Right now, some schools are doing it. Some school districts are friendlier to it than others. Is there any move to make it a right for students or parents to be able to opt out, or maybe a law for them to have to take it?
Sure. In Wisconsin, there actually is legislation that says that school districts must allow students who want to opt out of these state tests. So in Wisconsin, that law has been in place for a while now. But across the country, it's state by state whether or not they have a law that will let them opt out. In Illinois, for example, they don't have that law, so students have to take it.
Molly, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
We've been talking to Molly Beck, education reporter for the Wisconsin State Journal. She was with us to talk about the increase in parents opting their kids out of standardized tests in Wisconsin.
For marking Earth Day this week, nature writer Jill Sisson Quinn tracked a muskrat around her yard for several months. In the process, she discovered a whole ecosystem around her and within herself.
Lately, I have been on the trail of a muskrat. Before winter, his muddy mound of a home appeared through the leafless trees in a pond I have largely ignored. In spring, I encountered his tail-dragging tracks near a low bridge, and now, in summer, he seems to have vanished. Morning, evening, and afternoon stakeouts by what seems to be a feeding platform, a mat of mud and reeds and a cluster of cattails, have not revealed him. But since I have begun looking for one thing, I begin to see everything else. While I wait for the muskrat, wood ducklings paddle through the algaed pond as they once did their own yolks. Irregular rows of scented pond lily pads flap like the ruffles of a summer dress in unseasonable winds, showing their red undersides. Blue flag buds, not yet open, purse their petaled lips at my long intrusion. High up in a smooth stag completely shorn of bark, a family of pileated woodpeckers ducks angular red heads in and out, square pegs in a dark round hole. Under three logs nestle clutches of tiny freshwater pearl-like eggs, either redback salamander or land snail, I can't tell. One night, I hopscotched to the pond through a pleasant plague of microtoads. In one spot, on successive evenings, I rouse a small owl, twin fawns, and a gray tree frog. Next to him, under a downed branch, hides a blue-spotted salamander. I was looking for a muskrat, but I found a whole ecosystem. Ecosystem, a term coined less than a century ago when the English botanist A.G. Tansley wrote, "We cannot separate organisms from their special environment with which they form one physical system." A term illustrated further by our own Aldo Leopold. When I worked as a naturalist, I hiked the children deep into the woods for a scavenger hunt and asked them to find, in addition to plants and animals, the environment's abiotic factors, water, minerals, sunlight. We are in the sun, actually. The heliosphere, the sun's outermost layer, extends beyond the orbit of Pluto. Not hard to believe when you venture to the pond in the evening, working specifically around a muskrat's perceived schedule, and find you can see absolutely nothing due to the glare of the setting sun. After my long vigils on the weedy shore of the pond, I worry about the scavengers on me, ask my husband to take my book light and examine the places I can't see. We once spent 3 days, procured a magnifying glass even, trying to assure ourselves that a tiny spot on my left shoulder was not an embedded deer tick, but a freckle. When I return from my bushwhacking walks, sometimes I shake tiny beetles from my hair, cute speckled ones that wouldn't make anybody scream. But this is the least of it, really. Like the forest, like the pond, I am an ecosystem, hosting all kinds of microscopic life, mostly beneficial, on and inside me, 10,000 species, according to the Human Microbiome Project. So when I seek out the muskrat, regardless of whether I spot his slick-furred foraging, if I see the pond he swims in, I see him. For what we consider to be ourselves may be a strange invention, a fragile construct between two truer things, the world we harbor and the world we anchor in.
Wisconsin Life is produced by Erica Janik. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. For more info, check out wisconsinlife.org.
With Earth Day just a few days away, our next guest says this is a good time to think about the food we eat and where it comes from.
She came up with the idea to create a special meal to celebrate Earth Day. Joining us now to talk about this Earth dinner is Teresa Marquez. She's Mission Executive for Organic Valley. Teresa, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me. I'm so delighted to talk about Earth Dinner.
Well, tell us, what is Earth Dinner?
Well, I think I'll back up and say that in 2001, this is the 14th Earth Dinner year that we've been celebrating here, I had this thought about why wasn't Earth Day a national holiday? It's just so important to have one day a year that we acknowledge our faithful Earth. It just seemed like it made sense to me. And so I kept thinking, gee, I can't believe that we didn't. And, of course, in Wisconsin, Gaylord Nelson started Earth Day. So, you know, why haven't we, you know, made this a national holiday or a big holiday that we all are going to celebrate? And the thing that really occurred to me is, well, there's no dinner. And when I think about all of the great holidays that we like to celebrate, there's some food that goes with it. And so I started thinking about how we needed a dinner to help celebrate Earth Day with, and that if we had this dinner, it would have to be very special and would have to be with the Earth in mind. And so that's kind of the way it came about. And really, the other reasons that I'm in marketing, even though my title is mission executive, I was chief marketing executive for Organic Valley for almost 18 years. So a lot of things crossed my desk, and a few things really brought that idea of having a dinner to celebrate Earth Day home for me. One was I read that 25% of our meals are eaten in a car. And then the second thing that struck me to go along with that was that we stopped having dinner with the family dinner tradition. Many stopped having that. And instead, there's TV dinners in front of the TV. And in fact, a terrible statistic that children actually and their parents only have something like 5 to 10 minutes of really meaningful time during the day, for each day. And it made me realize that I was brought up in a very strict house, and oh, you were at the table at dinner. And there's a lot more that happens at a dinner table than just, you know, scarfing down food.
Well, let's get into what this Earth dinner looks like, Teresa. What are the ingredients? What are the components that make an appropriate Earth dinner?
Well, I'll just tell you a few of them, but I also always encourage people to use their own imagination and really get creative, because it's a great time to get creative. But of course, you want to know where your food comes from. And it's not like we're going to say, and only eat organic and only eat local. But, you know, once a year, wouldn't it be great to say, you know, I know where this food comes from. And the other thing that I love to advise is to have food with a story. Like, I like to think about, what did my grandmother eat? What did my family eat? Should I resurrect something or make something that my mother used to make, but maybe make it in a new way and be also honoring her? And while I'm also honoring where that food came from, what's its story, and, you know, why should we even care about where our food comes from? Since 2001, so many things have happened with regards to different organizations wanting to know your farmer, know your food. You just see these all over the place. So I think I was onto something when I thought, shouldn't we know where our food comes from? And, of course, the really, really important thing is to have your friends and family around and to share stories and talk about the food and where it came from and our connection to the earth. Just listening to the piece that just played before I got on, I loved something that was said, and it's that we're all connected. And so I think the Earth Dinner is an opportunity to really think about all the connections that we have with each other around food and how it comes from the earth. And one piece of information that I am I always find quite fascinating is that, you know, that one teaspoon of soil has more living things in it than there are people on earth. And it kind of gives you pause for thought that this wonderful food that we forget to think about, we just are scarfing down a lot of times, really comes from the soil, a lot of it. And it's a kind of a magical thing.
And Teresa, I want to get a taste. What's been maybe the biggest hit that you've put on the table on one of these Earth dinners?
I think that right here in the Midwest in April 22nd, who came up with that time for Earth Day? But it should have been like in the fall when we're harvesting things. So when we start looking around here, we love to do things with morels and ramps that you can find wild right outside right now. And so that's always a fun thing. The important thing, of course, is to know where your food comes from if you possibly can. And anything that you came from your family is always a fun story to talk about. One of the things that we did do to sort of stimulate these creative ideas of, gee, what should we have for dinner, or what's some of the great things, is we actually came up with a deck of cards to stimulate conversations, and you could pick one. And I'll just tell you what one of the favorite cards were, and it actually resulted in so many funny stories. But it's like, do you have a first memory of food? And if so, please share it with us. And so from there, we learned a lot about different food that people were both their favorites and their worst. And we found some of the memories of food where people, when they were little, remembering how much they disliked cauliflower, and when their mother wasn't looking, they would put it behind the radiator.
Sounds like a great conversation starter, Teresa. Thank you so much for sharing this idea of Earth Dinner with us today.
Oh, my pleasure. And please have an Earth Dinner on the 22nd.
That's Teresa Marquez. She's Mission Executive for Organic Valley. Talk about the concept of an Earth Dinner to celebrate Earth Day. From Cinderella to the movie Pretty Woman, relationships across social boundaries have been inspirations for fairy tales and feature films. But here in the United States, with growing attention to the economic divide between rich and poor, how do those relationships play out in reality?
Our next guest went straight to the source and interviewed people who had married someone richer or poorer. She learned about some of the unique challenges facing these relationships.
Jessie Stribe is with us now. She's an assistant professor of sociology at Duke University and the author of The Power of the Past, Understanding Cross-Class Marriages. Jessie, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Well, when you talk to couples about their class background, it seems like some of the initial reaction was, they didn't want to talk about it in some ways. What kind of reactions did you get when you introduced the idea of talking about cross-class marriages to people who are actually in them?
That's exactly right. So some of the people I talked to didn't think about themselves in a cross-class marriage. I would ask them when the first time they thought of themselves as being in a cross-class marriage was, and they would say something like, when I saw your email, or just now when I'm talking to you. Other people actively denied it. They said, no, we're not in a cross-class marriage because we're both moral people, or we both grew up with hardworking parents. So they found ways to kind of get around thinking about their class differences fairly often.
Why do you think they had the motivation to do that, to not describe themselves as being in a cross-class marriage so much as that they created workarounds?
I think part of the reason is class is so moralized in our country, and so they didn't want to see their partner as somebody who had different morals than them, who was maybe less moral than they were, and so they kind of said, oh, we're all the same. I think another reason is it's really hard to define class and to think about class. And so it's really easy to say, oh, we're middle class. Everybody's middle class. So my partner and I are too. Another reason is that when they met, they were often in the same class. So while they grew up in different classes, by the time they were adults, they were both college educated and often worked in professional jobs. And so they didn't really have to think about their class differences that were in the past anymore. They could focus on the future.
Well, let's look into the differences amidst the couples that you looked at. How roughly did you define class for the purposes of this research? And what were the backgrounds of the people in the marriages that you interviewed?
So I looked at people who grew up in different classes, but who are in the same class as adults. So as adults, they were college educated and they worked in professional white collar jobs, but their backgrounds were different. So in the couples I interviewed, one partner grew up with a father who worked in a blue collar job and who was high school educated, while the other partner grew up with a father who was college educated and worked in a professional white collar job. And often their mothers kind of had similar levels of education as their fathers. So one was a blue-collar background and one was a professional white-collar background.
We're talking about cross-class marriages right now with Jessie Stribe, assistant professor of sociology at Duke and the author of The Power of the Past. And Jessie, when you dug into this, to these cross-class marriages, what did you find stuck out to you first as far as the way people had differences that had to do with their upbringing?
Yeah, so one of the biggest differences I found was how they wanted to live their lives. And so generally, the person from the poorer background, the blue-collar background, tended to want to go with the flow. And their partners, who came from more privileged class backgrounds, instead wanted to manage everything around them. So they wanted to organize, and they wanted to oversee, and they wanted to plan, while their partners kind of wanted to take a more hands-off approach and say, we'll figure it out when we get there, and it's going to be okay. They worried a lot less. And so managing or taking a more hands-off approach were the biggest differences that I saw with cross-class couples.
And that seems like the sort of thing that might lead toward friction in a couple, having this fundamentally different way of approaching planning a life together.
It definitely could lead to a lot of friction, but it really didn't have to. And so a lot of the couples who were the happiest ones who I talked to found ways to make use of each partner's strengths. So the person who wanted to plan a lot would sometimes say, hey, I need to be more spontaneous sometimes. And my partner's really great at telling me to stop and smell the roses. Or I need to be as spontaneous in this situation. And so I go to her and I ask her how to do it. Whereas the partner from the blue-collar background would say, you know, sometimes I really need to plan more, but I don't know how to do it. And so I'm going to go ask my partner how to do it. And so they could see each other's differences as strengths at times, as well as just differences.
And was that the difference in quality that you talked about, the planning versus people who are more spontaneous? Was that something that attracted these people to each other? Was it a case of opposites attract?
There definitely were several cases of opposites attracting. It wasn't always about planning. Often for the person who grew up in a blue-collar community, it was about seeing the other person as very stable. So their partners who grew up with more privilege, often they thought the future was predictable because in their lives it was. And for people who grew up in blue-collar backgrounds, often predictability is a luxury. And so they felt really drawn to these people who just felt like, life is predictable. I know I'm going to go to college and then I'm going to go to grad school and then I'm going to have a good job. And that was a nice sense of security. For their partners who grew up from more privileged class backgrounds, they often felt that their families were less emotionally expressive as they wished. And their partners who grew up in blue-collar families often had really intimate families. And so the partner from more privilege wanted that and liked being around their partner and their family and felt like maybe they could teach them how to be more intimate too.
You mentioned at the outset that there can be moral baggage associated by people, fairly or not, with being from different class backgrounds. Within relationships, did you encounter ever a sense of either inferiority or superiority between the couples, or a sense that they're trying hard not to think of things in that exact way?
I think they tried hard not to think about it that way. Because they denied class, they didn't have to think about one person being better or worse than the other. Where it came up more often was when the in-laws met each other. A lot of times then the partner who came from the blue-collar family, their parents would feel inferior to their son or daughter's new parent in-laws.
Did you get the sense that these differences you're describing are things that lingered, or are they things that the couples worked on over time and sort of grew to a consensus over?
They definitely lingered. And so the couples stayed pretty different. So the blue-collar partner generally wanted to do less planning, and the more privileged partner generally wanted to do more planning. And that stayed constant throughout their marriages. But I think they got better at figuring out how to deal with those differences over time.
Well, can you bring this to life and maybe share a story or two of the couples, ones that you think really painted a picture of how these challenges work themselves out or not?
Sure. So one couple that I talked to, I call them Christy and Mike. These aren't their real names, mm-hmm. but names I gave them to protect their identities. And Christy and Mike met in seventh grade in the cafeteria, and they had pretty much been dating ever since then. When I met them, they were in their early 40s. They had three children together, and they were, at this time, both college-educated. Christy was a social worker, and Mike owned his own business. And they thought their differences were behind them. They had met really young, and they had spent really most of their life growing up together and being together. And so they thought their differences didn't matter. But there were really real differences. So Christy, for example, when thinking about money, would often tell Mike, live for the day. Don't worry so much. Don't budget so much. Don't think about what you're going to spend so much before you would spend it. And Mike would say, yeah, you know, Christy has a really good point. I do think a lot about money. But at the same time, we have three kids we want to send to college. We have a mortgage. Maybe thinking about money is not such a bad idea. with work, Mike would often say to Christy, where do you want to get to next? What should be your next promotion or your next job? Let's think about that a little bit more. And Christy would say to Mike, you're always thinking about your business. Why don't you think about that a little bit less? It's going to be okay. You're really good at what you do. With emotions, Christy would often tell Mike, you know, why don't you express them a little bit more freely? And Mike would still feel kind of like, oh, you know, I see your point and I see where you're coming from, but I want to think about them a lot more and plan out what I'm going to say before I say it. So they had to navigate all of these differences about money, about work, about emotions. And these really fell along the dynamics again of how much do you want to plan or how much do you want to assume everything's going to be okay and let it kind of go with the flow.
Listening to stories like that, did you have a sense that at the end of the day that these marriages between socioeconomic classes were stronger or ultimately more rocky overall and maybe more likely to end in divorce?
I think they had to deal with more differences, but I don't think that necessarily meant that they were more likely to end in divorce. So if you look at divorce rates, they're actually very similar for people who married somebody who grew up in a different class or people who married somebody who grew up in the same class. So I think it's how many differences do you have to negotiate, but the couples that I talked to were very able to figure out how to negotiate them.
We're talking about marriage and economics in the United States with sociologist Jesse Stribe. She studied the unique challenges faced by couples from different class backgrounds, different attitudes toward money, toward housework, and more.
You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Is this your story? Are you or were you in a relationship with someone who grew up richer or poorer than you? Did that cause problems or was it smooth sailing, no big deal? Do you think it's a bad thing that these cross-class marriages seem to be on the decline, a kind of economic segregation of marriage? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We continue our conversation with sociologist Jesse Stribe. She's the author of The Power of the Past, Understanding Cross-Class Marriages. She interviewed dozens of couples about the unique challenges facing people from different economic backgrounds.
You can join the conversation. Are you in one of these cross-class marriages? Call in at 800-642-1234. Are there differences in the ways you approach money, raising kids, having a household? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll go right to a caller. We've got John on the line in Janesville. John, hi.
Oh, hi. How you doing?
Good. What's your story, John?
Well, I just recently married my wife. We've been together just over 2 months now after the marriage. We've been together a little longer than that. But and she comes from a rather wealthy family, and I don't. I'm from the south suburbs of Chicago, very much working class, blue collar kind of family. And I actually didn't know that this was a subject of study, but it's been challenging at times.
How so? What have the challenges been? And first, congratulations, first of all, but what kind of challenges do you encounter because of those different backgrounds?
Well, first and foremost is just our different perceptions of money, I guess. That's kind of a nebulous thing to say. She has a bit of a loose interpretation of what it means to have money. I mean, she doesn't really seem to notice when she's spending it or, you know, it doesn't really occur to her that it's occasional that we may be short on funds. And fortunately for her, she's in a profession where that shouldn't really be a problem. But so I very much get nervous about the expenditures that we have. And we're looking at buying a home very soon, and that we're looking at houses that I would have never even considered stepping foot in as a child. Now it's within our budget.
John, thanks a lot for the call. Again, congratulations on your marriage. Jesse, so if you've grown up and used to worrying about money and growing up not having to worry about money, is this a common problem, do you think, in marriages across classes?
Yeah, I do think it is a common problem. I more often saw the reverse, that the person from the working class background who now was middle class, you know, had grown up worrying about money and now found it to be such a luxury that they didn't have to worry about money anymore. Whereas their partner who had always been middle class was much more worried and much more wanting to monitor where their money was going. But I think what John is hitting on is kind of really marrying somebody very wealthy instead of somebody who's been really middle class. And you can imagine that if you've always had a ton of money, there's never been anything to worry about. And so spending a little bit extra doesn't really seem like a big deal when you've always had so much money. Several of my respondents who kind of married up also talked, like John did, about going into a much bigger house. And for some people, that was kind of an anxiety-ridden thing, that it symbolized to them how far they had come. And some people, that was really an important thing to show that. And for other people, it was really uncomfortable because it showed the world how different they were from their background when they really didn't want to be so different. And so it went both ways. But I think John's experience is not that unusual.
John, thanks a lot for that call. And some really interesting findings in your book about the houses. You found that a lot of people had anxiety about trying to create the perfect, seemingly middle-class house, especially if they had grown up more working class, that they sort of wanted to pass for being middle class, and their house was the emblem of that.
Exactly, and especially for women. So women are judged more on the appearance of their house. And some of the women had been judged a lot as children growing up in homes that they thought showed that they were poor. So now that they were middle class and they had enough money to live in a middle class house, they wanted to really make sure they got it right and make sure that people wouldn't come to their house and know that they had grown up poor. So some of them really obsessed over how to make their house look like the middle class house in their head. But the problem was, since they didn't grow up doing that and living in that type of house or having friends who lived in those types of houses, they didn't really know what to do. And so they would kind of read blogs and read magazines and watch TV shows and really try to figure it out. But they often felt like no matter how hard they tried, they weren't getting it quite right. And so it became something that they kept trying on and kept putting a lot of effort in to make sure that they had this middle class house and that they would no longer be judged.
Talking to sociologist Jessie Strybe. She's been studying people who marry outside of their own class, marry people from different economic backgrounds, and the challenges and opportunities they face. Back to your calls now. We've got Elizabeth on the line in Madison. Elizabeth, hi.
Oh, hi. Thanks for taking my call. Very interesting subject. I come from a more blue-collar, working-class environment, and my husband, his father at one time was a multi-millionaire, so quite a difference. Nothing that I really thought about until we had a child, and our child is now a teenager. And just different things that come up. I'm definitely more worried about money. We did reach some financial hard times. I'm more on the worried side and you know, wanting to budget, et cetera, and wanting my child to, you know, work for, you know, either money or, you know, learn about responsibility with money. And I'm not as free as giving her extra funds, I think, as my husband is. And so I think that really has come to light. This subject is really interesting because it really brings a lot forth that I had never thought about before.
Elizabeth, thanks for sharing your story. Jesse, child raising, was that an issue where these different backgrounds created differences between parents?
Definitely at times. And one of the big differences is one that Elizabeth talks about, which is the idea of how much you want your kid to grow up working for things and how much responsibility you want your child to have. So a lot of the people who were upwardly mobile who I talked to said, I grew up struggling and I grew up making mistakes and having to learn from them. And nobody was there to prevent me from making a mistake. And that really helped me become resilient and become who I am today. So I want my child to have that too. I don't want to prevent them from making mistakes. I want them to make their own mistakes, and I want them to learn how to struggle. And people who didn't grow up having to struggle don't necessarily want their kids to have to struggle. And so they would have to try to figure out what's the right middle ground for this. Often with parenting, the woman had more control over kind of the whole parenting decision-making, and what happened was the wife got her way with it. But it was definitely a tension in the couples.
Well, thank you for that call, Elizabeth. And we'll go next to Martha in Milwaukee. Martha, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thank you.
My situation is that I came from a
fairly well-to-do family, and education was stressed a lot. And we were I grew up appreciating people of other classes, which is what my husband is. He grew up very poor, but I find our marriage has been very enriching because we're able to compromise, and I think it tests our true love. I think knowing that he grew up poor, I appreciate things more, and I appreciate him more, and I learn a lot, you know, by realizing that, yes, material things and status are important, but it's not everything. And it's a learning experience, and I think we enrich each other. It's sort of like we're educating each other, but, you know, we realize that it can be more than just money and different sides of the coin here.
Great, Martha. Thank you so much for sharing that. And it sounds like Martha and her husband are open to change, to growth, to seeing things from another's perspective. Is that key to making this sort of situation work?
I don't know if it's key to making it work that you recognize that it's about social class, but I think you have to be open to being with somebody who's different than you and being with their family who is different than you, and being open to learning a new way of going about holiday rituals or how to think about money. Do you give your parents money, or do you always expect your parents to give you money? Which way does that flow? How does gift giving work? How does planning work? How does child rearing work? And so you have to be open to doing things that aren't necessarily your way and not the way that you feel most comfortable with. But you don't have to know that it's about class to make that work.
Jesse's sociologist Robert Putnam, in his most recent book, says there are fewer opportunities for people from different classes to meet and interact, much less marry, and fewer interclass marriages over time. From your perspective, what do you make of that trend?
So I would say that there's two different trends going on. So the trend that Robert Putnam is talking about is cross-class marriages by college education. So somebody with a college degree marrying somebody with a high school degree, for example. And those marriages are becoming much, much less common over time. But the people who I interviewed aren't quite that set of people. They're people who now have college degrees, but they grew up in different social classes. And that type of marriage is actually becoming slightly more common. And so what we're seeing is people becoming perhaps more open to marrying across class lines of class background, of the class that they grew up in, while becoming less open to the idea of marrying somebody who doesn't share your current class position, or at least your current level of education.
So you see this breaking down in terms of education, and that's actually on the up and up. That's increasing.
So people who marry somebody who shares their college degree, that those marriages are increasing, the shared kind of education couples, while what's decreasing is somebody with a college degree marrying somebody with a high school degree.
All right, Jesse, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
That's Jesse Strybe, assistant professor of sociology at Duke University, author of the book The Power of the Past, Understanding Cross-Class Marriages. Talk about her recent research into the challenges of marrying people from different economic backgrounds. You can keep the conversation going. Keep sharing your story over at the Central Time Facebook page.